Greetings, I'm John Duvall. Welcome back to another Truth Factor discussion. I hope you're having a great day today. It's kind of rainy here in Oklahoma, but it's okay. Today we're going to be continuing Ecclesiastes. We're in chapter 6, verse 1. We'd like to thank you so much for joining us for our study today. Let me go ahead and bring everyone in, and then we'll pause for a minute and tell you how you can participate in this study, just in case you might have forgotten. Good morning, gentlemen. How's everyone doing today?
Morning.
All right.
Doing great.
Good. We have almost more of us today than we have in a while. We're still missing Brendan, of course, but he had something to come up. And Tom is not feeling well today, but he was gracious enough to join us and everything. So good to see you.
Yeah, leave your antivirus on so you don't catch what Tom has. That's all we can say.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that'd be the next thing. Tweak the virus to jump to computers.
The COVID computer vaccine.
That's right. All righty. Well, like I said, we're starting in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. Now, if you'd like to participate in today's study, you can do it a couple different ways, and you probably already know this. Leave a comment on the live stream on our Facebook channel, or Facebook page, I should say, or if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, then just use the chat area there. We'll be monitoring both areas. You can also contact us, send us email questions at truthfactorlive.com, and then write us individually if you would like at the various addresses there, john@paul@etc@truthfactor.com. We'd definitely love to hear from you. But let's go ahead and jump in then to this morning's study, Ecclesiastes 6. And let's go ahead and kind of introduce this by reading the first two verses there. And Brian, if you would, I'm going to throw this over to you. If you would read that, let me get this good to go for you. There's Tom. Go ahead and talk, Brian.
All right. I'll be reading Ecclesiastes 6, verses 1 and 2. And I'll be reading today out of the New King James Version. Ecclesiastes 6, verse 1 and 2. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is a common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires. Yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction.
Brian, that's pretty powerful, the way that he begins that idea there. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it's common to all men. What do you think? Do you think that would apply today, or do you think more of this would be something more? Well, go ahead.
Yeah. So in general, he's just going to start observing the idea of injustice. That of course this goes back to the whole: what's the meaning of life? Can you find the meaning of life? But one of the things he points out is not only can you not find the meaning of life, but there are these issues that come up: injustice, death, unfairness. These different kinds of things. Injustice is something that the world has had forever. You know, it's always been that there is a lack of justice for some people, particularly for the poor. But Solomon's point here is that even for the rich, there's injustice. There's unfairness in life. To have possessions and to have them stolen is unfair. I think it was C.S. Lewis had talked about the idea that, you know, being robbed is one of those things that makes you realize there's evil in the world because somebody has done something so fundamentally wrong to you. To take something you've worked for, something you've labored for, something that you've been blessed with, and just to take it from you is a testimony to the idea of evil. So Solomon is venturing now to say that even if there was a meaning in life, there are circumstances in life that then dissolve that meaning. And injustice is one of several that he's going to point out.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and this is very consistent all throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. I mean, there's. I know I wasn't with you all the last week or so, but I know that this is just a common thread all throughout the things of why life is vanity. There's just no guarantees. It doesn't matter what you have. And I don't know if you all mentioned COVID last week. you know, in your discussions about these things, or if we've talked about that, you know, COVID made a lot of rich people poor, a lot of poor people rich. And what I mean by that is people that were depending on what they had lost it. You know, for one reason or another, all of a sudden the security of life is gone and those types of things. And there's just so many examples of this. You know, think about this text with what's going on right now with Russia and the Ukraine. You know, you had people in the Ukraine that were living their lives, and you've got a foreigner, a bully that just comes in and takes everything away, destroys it. And so, yes, these things definitely happen today, locally and internationally.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing I was thinking about, let me kind of pop over here for a minute. Let's get the grid back up of everyone. Well, almost. There we go. So, flimsy hands there with all this. Okay, there's interesting stuff we could talk about. And I think Tom just kind of introduced an idea there that is really what Solomon is probably pulling from, at least within the experience of kingdoms, on maybe a twofold front. Although God was with Solomon at any point, and he had seen it in his life with other nations, this is why he set up treaties and so forth, other nations would come into a wealthy nation and decimate and take everything they had. So you had this king working for years and years and years, and overnight it goes. Think about jumping forward in time from Solomon's point when the Medo-Persian army came into Babylon there the night that Belshazzar was throwing his huge party and everything, and then they saw the handwriting on the wall. Overnight, it was all gone for him. And so when we kind of look at this text, what is being said here by y'all is exactly true. We work so hard for everything, put so much emphasis in it, and whether it's death or whether it's the IRS or COVID, you know, there were a lot of businesses that were shut down that went out of business because COVID and the people in charge demanded a forced shutdown, and the people lost their livelihood, lost their income. And Solomon observes that all this effort to lose it like that, he says it's vanity and it's an evil, evil affliction. Any other thoughts before we go forward?
It could even be looked at as maybe a person who works their whole life to amass wealth, and then they hand it down to others. I knew of a lady who, and no one here would know them, probably no one online would know them, but she had somehow become very wealthy. And she said the one thing that she did not want was a certain part of her family to get that money. And she had a will that indicated that, because they were not very good people. They were not very good to her. And when she died, they could not find the most recent copy of her will. And the very people that she did not want to have her wealth ended up with all that she had. And so here, you know, you work, you know, you try to protect it, you do all that you can, and then someone else ends up with it. It just tells you not to put your trust in riches. So.
You know, real quick, putting this in the spiritual perspective and so on. Obviously, this is part of what I would describe as the curse, you know, the curse that was put on the world as a result of sin. And so on. You could describe it as thorns and briars, you know, that appear as a result of sin in the world. And so, I mean, that's just one of the things to deal with. I mean, life is unfair, and that's what makes it vanity, which is the emphasis of Ecclesiastes. And I know we've probably said that a million times already, but guess what? So did Solomon. I mean, so if we sound like a broken record, I tell you what, you read Ecclesiastes and then you read Proverbs, it sounds like a broken record. And that's the truth. So anyways, enough.
We got a comment. I'm going to go ahead and bring it in before we get too far ahead. Andy says, does that mean a person should not do anything since things can be taken away? It should seem a person should not do anything in life except to worship God and Jesus. And we kind of talked about this. The ultimate arc of the book of Ecclesiastes is not to say, don't work, don't provide for yourself, don't enjoy life. The overall arc is to do these things, but making sure that you understand that in the end, it is your service to God that matters. That everything else you do, and put a lot of effort in it. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, but understand it will go the way of the wind. And when all the chaff is finally blown away from your existence, you are left standing before the throne of God. He's going to judge you. He'll judge me as well, based on the way that we served him in the life that we lived here on this earth. I would even go as far as to say that the idea that it would seem to a person should not do anything in life except to worship God and Jesus would then violate other principles. If a man doesn't work, neither shall he eat. Paul rebukes the brethren in Thessalonica, the few who had quit working and had become busybodies. The young widow women, they are told to marry because idleness within their life would be something that would be very bad for them. So, and that's a poor paraphrase, but you understand what I'm saying. So there are responsibilities that we have to take care of. We have to take care of ourselves. We have to work. We have to eat. We have to rest. We have to raise our family. There's a lot of physical things. So we can't simply say, let me discard everything. I'll quit my job and then go and serve God and Jesus, because then at the same time, there are things that they've told us to do that we're saying, well, I don't want to do those things because I'd rather go and tend to these areas of service that I find more important. But I think the overall idea here is like what we said. Yes, do these things, but if they're the only thing in your life, that's where the vanity comes in, because you have that you can't take them with you. Bury the Pharaoh with his servants and his jewelry and his chariots, and they all will go to dust. It's just that simple. Guys, any thoughts about that you want to share with them?
1 Timothy 6:17. Hey, don't trust in uncertain riches. You know, command the rich. Just don't put your trust in those things. Or again, Matthew 6:19, do not lay up for yourself treasure on earth. So, I mean, it's a matter of priority. It's exactly like you said, do what you're supposed to do. We're expected to be productive. And by the way, you know, to answer that question about does it mean we should not do anything, the Bible does not condemn wealth. The Bible does not condemn the wealthy. Many righteous souls described in the Bible were very wealthy, but they had proper perspective.
Yeah. And you don't serve God to become wealthy.
Right.
You know, you don't say, well, I'm going to go help other people in hopes that God will throw a little extra my way. You know, those motivations are wrong. And God, of course, knows the heart. Paul made tents. Paul refused to accept support from certain churches like the church in Corinth. And he worked. He very well could have said, I'm not going to work again because I'm a preacher of the word of God, and I'm going to spend all my time doing that. But he, Priscilla and Aquila, they made tents. They did their work. Matthew probably maintained his job as a tax collector once Jesus died and then rescinded back up into heaven. The Peter, James, and John, they all probably continued being fishermen, you know, as they continued to preach the word. So that's what we're trying to say, it's what we've said before in our study. When you study the Ecclesiastes, take the whole picture. You know, because Solomon is painting, as Brian says, an experiment from start to finish. You know, and all of it has to be factored in to finally see the end conclusion there. Yeah. Truth and Reason shares with us that same phrase there. For man does not work, neither shall he eat. Coming then from 2 Thessalonians. No, I'm sorry. That's 1 Timothy chapter 5, isn't it? Or 2 Thessalonians 3?
2 Thessalonians 3, you're right.
Okay, it is that one. Okay, all right. The other one, 1 Timothy 5, and talking about supporting widows from the family. If a man doesn't provide for his own, or if one doesn't provide for his own, he's worse than an infidel. And that'd be another passage in that direction there.
Yeah, 1 Timothy 5:8.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and continue forward with this. Appreciate that question there and the comments there with that. Let's go ahead and read. This will be kind of maybe an odd break. But Paul, if you would read for us verses 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Will do. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, beginning at verse 3, and then reading down through verse 6. If a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. For it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place.
All right, so Paul, as we back up there, looking in this in the text here, he talks about a very prosperous man, doesn't he? He begets 100 children. Imagine getting married and saying, "Dear, I want to have 100 kids," and she'll say, "Well, you'll need 299 more wives. You'll need 700 concubines as well." But after all this, what's his conclusion if you lose all those things?
Well, it seems to be that there's some, he's got all these children, but no one who really cares about him. If I'm reading this right, he's got a lot of years. He's got a lot of children. He's not satisfied with goodness, it says there, indeed has no burial. And so it sounds like that here he's got all these, he's begot all these children. And you would think, you know, he'd have someone who cares about him, someone to take care of him, someone to bury him when he's gone. But that just doesn't happen. And he compares that with a stillborn child who has not had those experiences of life, has not been able to enjoy all of that. I'm not sure about the idea his soul is not satisfied with goodness. I don't know if that's in regard to having those many children. We know that children are a heritage from the Lord, and that they're a blessing. And the scripture says that the man whose quiver is full of them, they're like arrows, and the man whose quiver is full, that he's a blessed man. And so maybe it's saying that in all that goodness that God has given him, he doesn't find any satisfaction. He doesn't find any happiness in all of that. And then the stillborn child comparison there seems to be that someone who's never had those experiences and never begot any children, never had those kind of family relationships outside of the womb, that child is not really a whole lot different than the man who finds no goodness and doesn't even have anyone to bury him as he lives through his life.
It's interesting, Paul, that the Holman Christian Standard Bible renders it, no matter how long he lives, if he is not satisfied by good things and does not even have a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little different way of looking at it.
Yeah, I kind of see that idea of contentment and being satisfied. You know, Paul, you mentioned the Psalm 127:3, you know, which is the one about the children are a heritage from the Lord and so on. And I think that's the best description of this. He's using the exaggeration here. You know, suppose somebody was blessed with that much heritage and so on, and he's not satisfied. He's not content with what he has. It's not enough. He wants more. And how many people that want more neglect what they have as far as family and things like that, and they end up losing all of that because it's about the pursuit of whatever it is. And then, as a result, you know, he has 100 children. He's when he dies, there's no funeral. Nobody shows up. You know, imagine how sad that is. Probably because half his children are at the lawyers, you know, arguing over who's going to get what, those types of things. What a tragedy. Better if you were never born. It's the bottom line.
Yeah. Well, the next question I want to ask here is of Brian. So, Brian, I'm going to focus for a moment on verses 4 or 5, or actually the latter part of 3. I say that a stillborn child is better than he, for it comes in vanity and departs in darkness, and its name is covered with darkness. though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man, even if he lives 1,000 years. Brian, is he talking about the stillborn? When he says, I say that a stillborn child is better than he, for it comes in vanity, etc.?
So I think there's a couple of ways to look at this, that we're, it's just an abstract thought or it's something very specific. If it's very specific, the point is we know that unborn children that perish even before birth are in some ways some of the most blessed people there are, because they're never accountable for their sins. They, you know, the Bible is clear that it, in the womb, we're still a person made in the image of God, that there's a certain degree of, you know, if we thought about it, they're the most fortunate people in the world, because they'll be able to, you know, be before the presence of God. They don't have to endure sin in any way. And that's really a fortunate thing. There's also an abstract idea here. And that is that a lot of times when people are really miserable, they just say, I wish I'd never been born. You know, Job, I wish I'd never been born. Jeremiah, Moses, people just say, I wish I was dead. You know, I wish I wasn't here. I wish I'd never been here. And which is a common feeling for people whenever they're overwhelmed, whenever they're full of grief, whenever they're just beset by so many things, they start to say, you know, life, just this isn't worth the life that I have. And so there's an abstract idea here, too, that, you know, sometimes you make that contrast to say, you know, if I'd have never been born, it would be a lot more fortunate thing. So specifically, unborn children that perish have a fortunate characteristic that, you know, in the great scheme of things, makes them among the most fortunate individuals there are. Abstractly, though, the idea is sometimes you just wish you'd never been born.
And I kind of wonder if maybe that's the latter part there, Brian, because you think about the stillborn child comes in vanity, departs in darkness. He doesn't know life. He doesn't even have a name. Okay. And he says that stillborn child is better than the man with all his wealth, lives 2,000 years, but never finds or sees goodness. That child that was never born has it better off than the man who had all this. And the point is the latter part, do not all go to one place. That's kind of the comparison there. Yeah. All right. Any other thoughts or comments from the gallery, sorry. Any thoughts on it? Okay. All right. They're not a peanut gallery. Maybe some cashews or something. Macadamia nuts, but. Peanut, all right. Let's look at the next. Pea brain. Pea brain. So let's go ahead and look at the next section there. Let's see. Tom, if you would, read for us there, beginning in verse 7. And let's go ahead and take it to the end of the chapter, if you would, please.
All right. Verses Ecclesiastes 6, 7 through 12. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better in the sight of the eyes than the wandering, or better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already. For it is known that he is a man, and he cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow. Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun?
Okay. All right, Mr. Tom, let's see. Let's go back there to verse 7 for just a moment. We kind of see, of course, the same idea here being established through the text here, kind of building upon what he said. You've got all the labor of man is for his mouth. That means he works to eat, I'm assuming. And yet, he says his soul is not satisfied. I guess the ultimate problem is, Tom, is that what we face is that we set about our life, we, mankind, sets about his life to fulfill his physical needs. And he spends all his time and effort fulfilling those physical needs. And then when he dies, those physical needs are gone. All his effort is for naught. What do you say? It's kind of the idea that's being built here.
Yeah, well, you've got that. You've definitely got that as the idea. You've also got you've also just got to consider the fact that, you know, you talk about the labor of man is for his mouth. You know, he feeds himself. How long does that last before he has to eat again? You know, that's just the nature of life, the way that it keeps going and so on. But you also have the idea that as he's working and he feeds himself and so on, like you said, spiritually not gratified, and that of course is a tragedy. So that's what that's dealing with, as far as I can see. So,
okay, all right, Paul, what about verse 9 there,
where it says, I'm going to read. I've got both. The New King James says, "Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire," and the CSB says, "Better what the eyes see than wandering desires. This too is futile in a pursuit of the wind." Maybe if we're talking about, as you mentioned, the idea of contentment and has been brought forth here, maybe it's better just to be satisfied with what's in front of you than always wanting more and more. It's kind of like in the previous chapter that the one who has silver is not satisfied with silver. And so it's better just to be satisfied with, and that's not to say never to have, as you know, one of our one of the viewers brought out, it's not saying never to have any ambition or try to achieve more or try to do any better than where you are. It's not really saying that, but it's saying to learn contentment rather than always desiring something bigger and better and greater. I think maybe.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, or go ahead, Tom.
You know, I was going to say, you know, when you think of somebody that likes to sightsee, and you, the computers actually enhance this more. You know, I mean, we've always had picture books and stuff as long as we've been alive, but now you can see videos of the places that you want to go, and it doesn't matter how much you've seen. If you're a traveler, if you're a wanderer, you always want to see more, and you're just not satisfied. And it goes back to what Paul was saying about contentment, that's one of those key qualities that's fundamental, or what I call foundational qualities, that we need to have in our lives as Christians. I mean, we need all kinds of characteristics, but there's some fundamental ones that need to be at the underpinning of our very character, and contentment is one of those. Humility is one of those.
Yeah. Well, the common phrase we often quote of Paul, godliness with contentment is great gain. That's fundamentally the summation of what we're talking about here. Yeah. We've got a comment coming in from Mike Davis. Let's go ahead and bring that up. Michael says, there's a degree of depression in Solomon's statement here. Depression is within itself a killer, and often caused by not seeing the value of God's blessings, both spiritual and temporal. Then the next one, he goes on to say, it would appear he is showing us that God is the answer to depression and the guide to showing us how to accept the temporal blessings as they are comforts for this life, but not eternal. I really wonder about that, Mike. If there's not a generation of kids coming up, I say kids, young people in general, those younger than I am, maybe those of my own age even, who, because of the social structure of life and what has been brought about with the age of the internet and all that, if discontentment is what's fueling much of, or I should say some of, the psychological problems that our young people are facing. I'm not discounting actual psychological, physiological problems. I'm not discounting that. But I think some people are looking for something. They're looking for fulfillment. They're looking for something better. They're looking for something that they can't find, and they look in the wrong places. And so therefore, happiness is always evading them, and they're looking for things and grabbing things that aren't bringing what they're truly looking for. And Mike kind of touches on that there with that comment. Any thoughts?
I do think we need to be careful. I think there is an absolute truth in what Mike said, that Sometimes we bring upon ourselves our own discontent and our own problems, depression, in a very common sense, not in a clinical sense. But I know that I think among our brethren, there was a period of time where we kind of looked down upon anyone who said they had depression or any kind of mental illness and said, well, God is the answer for that, and you just don't have enough faith. That's why, you know, you're suffering from this. And I don't think that's always the case. I think there is mental illness, and I think there is chemical imbalances and things of that nature. And so, yes, we all need God more and more in our lives, and sometimes it is that those kinds of feeling very down and blue and unhappy is our discontent and our lack of closeness with God. And sometimes it is a medical condition that we're probably not qualified to diagnose or treat.
Yeah. But I think, and I agree completely with, I agree with that. And, but in, how to put this? There's, in most mental illness cases, and I realize this is not true in every single one of them, but in most of them, there's still the underlying control over what we do. You know, it may be hard, it may be difficult. We may have to push through it. Much of the anatomical issues that can develop with our body, heart disease, cancer, muscular disease, and things of that nature, may strongly inhibit a person, but they can still walk. I'm not going to say walk, move forward. We've had two ladies at this congregation, both have since passed away, but they both had suffered from stroke early in their life. And this one sweet lady, it'd take her 5 minutes to get through the door threshold, but she was doing it by herself. You know, she was on a walker and everything with only one good working arm. But she would be there every time she possibly could. And I think there are times where even when a person may be going through a state of depression, there's still the thought control there. It may be hard. It may be difficult. It may be hard to see through the fog. But even then at that point, especially with parents, with children, or with spouses, you kind of have to understand they're going through, it's like a woman going through extreme postpartum depression. You know, the husband, if he ever says to her, look, just trust God and love God more and you'll be happy. Don't do that. Run away from the iron skillets and everything. I agree. And Michael says, let me bring his in. He says, I agree, John. The only true happiness is in Christ, and Solomon is speaking to that fact. That's right. Solomon's really not dealing with what we would call mental depression and things of that nature. What he's dealing with here is the depression that comes when we seek to satisfy our own desires, and we realize that when we die, it all goes to nothing, and we forget that God is the greater one that we should be putting first and foremost in our life. And Danielle says, amen. Thank you, Paul. And Michael then says, while medical conditions exist, many are self-inflicted because of seeking happiness in vain entities. That's true, too. And then Chris Kramer, known as Truth and Reason, he's on a different account. He said, so Paul told Timothy to take a little wine for his stomach's sake. God does not prevent us from seeking medical treatment for ailments. To refuse treatment is expecting God to work a miracle. And I've known Christians in the past who would just... If you had to turn to Prozac, then you just didn't trust God enough.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of...
That's not good.
I got to harp in on this, because I think this is important, what you're saying, what Paul has said, and what we're leading up to. And by the way, just a small plug. I know that Chris Kramer puts out a study at Truth and Reason. It's well worth it if anybody has a chance to go visit that site and listen in on his work there. But, you know, the thing about depression is depression's like pain. Pain is all in your mind. You know, does that make it not real? You know, because pain isn't something that I can look at and see. Pain dictates our way we act. It dictates our emotional levels. It dictates so much of our life. Depression is pain. It's a type of reaction to stimuli that really wrecks us. And I always go back to Genesis chapter 4 with God talking to Cain, and God tells Cain, you have to lift your countenance. Cain is depressed. He says, Cain, you got to treat that. You got to take care of that. I tell people that are in a lot of pain, take care of that. Don't think, no, I can get over it, because God expects you to use whatever resources you have in order to do so. Jesus gives us the parable of the unfaithful steward, or the parable of the unjust steward who uses whatever resources he has in order to secure his future. And Jesus says, hey, that's smart. Use whatever you can to secure your future. If you're struggling with depression, with pain, don't have the expectation that just by spiritual strength I can overcome. You probably need help. I mean, we can't each, it's kind of Galatians 6. He talks about us bearing our own loads, but he also says bear one another's burdens. And so, there are some things we can do by ourselves, but there's a lot more we can't. You need to accept that. And you guys have made some great comments about that that are important.
I agree, Brian. All right. Any other thoughts on that? And don't be afraid to seek help. When we were born, Paul and I and Tom a few years earlier, Brian some years later, knowing to look for signs of postpartum depression in new mothers was not the same as it is today. Nowadays, if you're a new mother and you're having some, especially if you're going through, what do they call it? Some sort of life events. Okay. So some doctor will say that you can handle 3 or 4 life events, which would be having a child, death in the family, a major move, loss of a job. But at some point, your body begins to be overwhelmed. And if you have a new mother who's also going through, a move of house, or maybe a loss of a loved one, that's going to have a major effect on the chemical. And so they're starting now to, when you go into the doctor and you start saying certain things, and I don't mean what we would call, I don't know what I'm trying to say. But anyway, they know what to watch for. And they can say, okay, we can give you this. That'll help balance and level everything out. Don't be afraid to do that, But none of us are doctors. None of us play doctors on TV. But we have had experience with people who have gone through things like this. And we've seen, all of us, I believe, have seen situations like this. Okay. One more. Let's bring in Andy's comment here. That's a good question, because there are so many areas of this we could talk about. What about those who have disabilities that make life harder than the medical? They don't know how to help, like in the case of autism. That's right. I mean, there are situations like that that cannot be solved overnight, may not yet be solved. Now, I would suggest, though, if you're dealing with something such as this, that you find someone who is also going through it, has gone through it. If you know of someone, let's talk about autistic children. If a couple has an autistic child, the child clearly has the signs of it, and it looks like that way, find other couples, other families who have raised autistic children and learn early from them. What methods did they use? How did they work with them? Learn from others. You don't have to reinvent the wheel with every child. Learn from other people who have gone through the same challenges that you might be going through at this time. Not, I'm saying you, Andy, but just in general. Yeah.
Amen, John. But the first treatment for most medical mental health, emotional health issues are support groups.
Yeah.
And what is the support group that Jesus died to purchase? I mean, let's appreciate the significance of that. Sometimes, though, you do need support from people that know specifically and exactly what you're going through. But truthfully, never, ever underestimate the power of the church that Jesus built and the support group that we have. God does, I always say salvation is a team sport. God expects us to be working with others on this. And again, that Galatians 6, verse 2, bear one another's burdens, fulfill the law of Christ. I always like that, fulfill the law of Christ. You can't get to heaven without this support group. And the emotional burdens we bear, the first and most important thing we have, the first important thing we have is prayer, but we have a group with each other. Where people fail with that is they turn inward. They say, I'm not going to share this with anybody. I'm just going to keep this to myself. I'm just going to let it, and it overwhelms every time. That's the biggest mistake people make, is that they don't want to share it. We're afraid of being judged. We're afraid of being looked down upon. And yeah, there are unspiritual people in any church that may not have the right perspective, but surely there are spiritual people in every church who say, hey, I understand what you're going through, and I'm here to help.
Yeah.
We have all types of resources, which you all have been mentioning. We're blessed to live in a time where we acknowledge these types of things and so on. But understanding the overall picture, when you look at a question like that Andy just asked, you know, you also just have the concept, the realization that life is unfair at times. I mean, we don't know why some of these things happen. And one of the things we have to avoid in that is blaming God or becoming angry at God because of those types of things. And that's a challenge. You know, that's extremely a challenge. But that's kind of the point that Solomon keeps driving at in this book, the vanity of life. Life is vain. There are so many things in this life that are unfair. But the whole thing is that that doesn't determine the outcome of our soul. Our reaction does, the way that we live. That's what's going to determine things, which is why the ending of this book, when we get to it, it just ties everything. I think we need to ask that question with everything you read in this book, and you ask, well, what about this? What about that? Well, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. God's going to, in the end, God's going to reward accordingly. So, let's have a proper perspective with whatever we're dealing with in life.
That's a good point. And talking about the support group, pardon me just a minute here. Talking about the support group, another thing with that, and this goes back to what Brian's saying, you find out you're not alone, you know, and go back to the church, you're not alone. And Mike chimes in here about the benefit of worshiping together. All right. He says here, this is why worship is so valuable. It grants us a time to share one another's burdens. Now, I realize people are trying to hurry to get out of services so they can go eat lunch or something like that, but it helps build a relationship with other people that you may feel free enough to turn to and talk to them about it. And there's so many things that we could get into with this. I mean, if you have an individual who is dealing with an alcohol addiction or drug addiction, maybe things of even that type of nature. If you find someone that has gone through it and has come out successful, then they can relate to you. I mean, if you come up to me and say, John, I've got an alcohol problem, I can't relate to that. I can give you platitudes. I can tell you what the Bible says. I can say, well, just don't drink. Get control over it. Don't do it. But someone who has had that problem and has overcome it, they can tell you, okay, let me tell you, it's a hard journey. You're going to be this way for the rest of your life. You've got to control just so many things they can better relate to. And that's the benefit of turning to someone who's already been through that situation. Yeah. All righty. It is 11:49. We've made it through chapter 6. Do we want to go any further into chapter 7? Or do we want to just call it an early lunch today?
Yeah, chapter 7 really picks up on a different way of thinking. Chapter 7 is going to drop us a little, anecdotes of wisdom. Things that in the course of this conversation, I don't think they're independent of the conversation. I think they're just things that Solomon says, you know, in all of these observations, picked up a few things, and he's going to want to drop us those. So a little bit of a different subject here.
So it might be a good break.
Yeah.
It might be a good break. Yeah, I was going to say, if we give the audience a break today, then next week, if we go a little long, they can give it back to us.
No, you give a mouse a cookie, he's going to want a glass of milk. You give the audience 10 minutes free today, they're going to want 11 minutes next week. The audience.
Well, hey, eventually people. We'll get that balance, right?
There you go. All right, well, let's plan to do that then. We'll plan to continue this study next Thursday. We'll start chapter 7, verse 1. Listen, I appreciate the questions and comments. There are other things going on in the discussion there in the comments. It's really hard to bring into the study. Things are more of a personal nature. But when everything is said and done, with whatever disabilities, if you want to call it disability, hindrances, whatever it may be, we have to always at least try to remember to push ahead. Okay, whether it's a physical disability, it's a psychological disability, And keep this in mind. God knows every single part of us. He knows every hair on our head is the idea there. So whatever a person is going through, whether the disability may be psychological, maybe it's something from an injury, no matter what it is, the Lord knows those things. And I think that's very important to remember. I'm not trying to say that an individual can go and live a life of drunkenness and pray to God every now and then and everything's going to be fine for him. I'm saying the Lord knows the hearts and the minds of men. And so as we would say, we oftentimes say with the child, when a child dies, we hold the position that the child is innocent because he's too young to be guilty of sin. He's too young to know what that he or she is doing. There's not the ability to sin with lying within the arm of the child when they reach up and grab their mother's necklace. That's not true. They're not guilty of sin when they do that. And so even as adults, in our service unto our Heavenly Father, He knows everything within our hearts and our minds. And that can be a comforting thing. It can also be a very scary thing as well. So press onward, keep going, do your best in serving the Lord, and don't give up, no matter what obstacles we may face. Well, appreciate everyone's participation. Guys, appreciate your comments. Appreciate Chris and Alan and Eileen. Eileen? Aileen.
Alan?
Eileen. Eileen. And Danielle as well. Appreciate all your participation. And if there's nothing else, gentlemen, is there? No? No. All right. We'll see everyone next Thursday at 11 o'clock a.m. for our next Truth Factor discussion, Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1. Y'all have a great week.